Well, it's good afternoon from UK Column. If you're in the UK, it's good evening. If you're in the USA, and more importantly, as you'll find out in a minute, it's a very early good morning to Canada. And I really want to thank all of our international viewers, our international experts, because hearing from everybody gives us a better picture of what's going on, and no more so than today, because many people may know that I, Debbie Evans, am a retired state registered nurse, and I trained dinosaur years ago. And many of you will remember, I'm sure, the family doctor. Do you remember the family doctor? The doctor you could rely on, the doctor that knew your family, knew your children, perhaps was there and delivered your children, delivered your grandchildren, perhaps were there when some of your family passed. The family doctor was absolutely central to the community and is central to the community. But in 2024, have we lost sight of the family doctor, the reliable family doctor that turns up at 3 o'clock in the morning, that answers the door no matter what, because they're there to help you? My kids call me old-fashioned, but sometimes I think old-fashioned is good. And normally I'm scrambling around for titles for this, for interviews. But today, I haven't even chosen a title yet, because I think I might throw out a few titles to my guest. And some of those titles, to give you a little clue of what he's been through, should we call this interview Weaponizing Medicine? Perhaps with a question mark. Perhaps we should call it The Doctor Who Listens to Patients. Maybe The Good Samaritan. A Pandemic of the Vaccinated. David versus Goliath. The Upside Down World. Power of Fear. Towing the Line. Basic Honesty. Never Give Up. Or perhaps Firestarter. And I say that for a reason. So I am absolutely so humbled and privileged to be joined today by a family doctor who listens to his patients and observes his patients. A family doctor in Canada, Dr. Charles Hoff. Welcome to UK Column, and thank you so much for agreeing to join us.
Well, you're most welcome, and thank you so much for allowing me to be on your show. This is a great privilege, thank you.
We've been watching very closely. I've been watching your story, Dr. Hoff, and I know our viewers and listeners that haven't heard your story are going to be pretty shocked, because you have been through a nightmare. And we've heard from doctors in the UK, but I've also noticed since the pandemic how closely Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the UK seem to be acting in lockstep. And for you, it all started really, didn't it? Because you say yourself, you're a very humble man. You live in a humble town and you just get on with your job. And yet things changed for you. Just give us a little background of what happened, what changed, and what did you notice?
Well, I think, well, what happened was very early on, I realized that COVID was being massively, the risk of COVID was being massively exaggerated by the authorities, that, you know, that most emergency rooms were much quieter than usual, yet we were told the healthcare system was under enormous strain and was on the verge of collapse. Which I think in each hospital, each doctor, each place thought, well, it must be somewhere else, because obviously we're getting off very lightly. But I realized very early on that the media were not being honest, and that the medical authorities were not being honest, and that people were being terrified about something that was literally no more dangerous than the flu. And so I think that was the first thing I noticed. When there was a serious safety signal with the AstraZeneca shot in Europe, and a whole number of countries in Europe had shut it down, and Canada said, no, well, it's fine for Canadians, even though it's no good for people in Europe. I sent an email to a group of my colleagues who were actually giving these shots because I knew there was no safety data to assure us that these shots were safe. And so I was given a gag order very early on for basically drawing attention to a safety signal. And I was told that I was putting people at risk because I was creating vaccine hesitancy amongst my medical colleagues. This wasn't even with the public. This was a private group email to people in our area. And so I was immediately thought, this is very odd. Doctors are supposed to be very concerned about patient safety. So if I'm given this gag order for even questioning the safety of a product on which there was no long-term safety data, there was something very fishy. And then when I started to see the serious harm in my own patients who had received their first shot, I knew that it was my social responsibility to protect my patients. And so even though I'd been given this gag order, and my gag order was that I was not allowed to say anything negative about these shots in the course of my job as an emergency room doctor in my little town. And I was told that this was being sent as a letter of complaint to the licensing authority here, which is the College of Physicians and Surgeons. And so this was a formal reprimand. And so I initially thought that was very odd. But nevertheless, when I saw the harm that was happening to my patients, I knew I had a social responsibility to speak up. And so I defied my gag order and I sent an open letter because I knew if it was a closed letter, it would be buried. It was clearly that the authorities weren't being honest and they were clearly covering up the evidence of harm. And I wasn't willing to participate in that. So I sent this as an open letter, which attracted a lot of attention. And I said in the letter how many people had been vaccinated, how many vaccine injuries I had seen so far, and that our town hadn't had a single COVID casualty whatsoever until that point. And so it was clear to me that the shots were more dangerous than COVID. So anyway, this unfortunately really riled the authorities. And then I was told that I just have to report these vaccine injuries. And when I tried to do that, every single one was met with denial. They said, nope, these are not vaccine injuries. These are all coincidences. And ultimately, I've tried filing 14 vaccine injury reports, and every single one was blocked and denied. And they said, nope, they will not register them as vaccine injuries. These are all coincidences. Even though in many cases, the symptoms had literally started within a few hours, but they wouldn't accept these were vaccine injuries because the manufacturer hadn't said that those were possible side effects. And so I realized that the cover-up was extensive and it was widespread and it was at the highest levels. And so that's really where this started, was me seeing the endemic corruption in those that had authority over me. And yeah, that's really where it started.
I'm horrified, actually, because on a number of counts, but would it be fair to say, I mean, I don't know how you must have felt, because essentially, I'd say, Charles, you were dobbed in by your colleagues. You know, you were betrayed by your own profession, by people that you knew. This, you were asking other consultants, other doctors, you were observing, and they betrayed you. Did you feel that?
Yes, I did. You know, I was part of I'm trying to remember what it was even called. It's sort of a society of rural doctors of British Columbia, which gave one access to all sorts of funds for medical education and other things, which are sort of perks of being in a rural area. And I was expelled from them. In fact, they told me they were going to have a special meeting to expel me for causing vaccine hesitancy. And so because I knew this was clearly a political thing, it was not a moral or medical or scientific thing, this was political action. So because I didn't want them to be able to use that against me saying that I was expelled, I said, well, I'm just resigning. So I just resigned from this organization, which then cut off my access to funds that would otherwise have been able to help me. And so this was what was happening from my own colleagues, who were so brainwashed from watching their television set, who really, really believed that this was a terrifying disease that was going to decimate the population, and that our only hope out of it was to get everyone vaccinated as fast as possible. So anything possible that discouraged vaccination was seen as literally betraying humanity. And I think, obviously, I saw it from a very different perspective. My sense of social responsibility was that doctors should do no harm. And that seems to have gone out the window.
You're a very humble Christian gentleman, Charles. And I just want you to give our viewers and listeners a perspective of your life, because you didn't have these massive aspirations of being chief medical officer of Canada or anything, did you? You were a family doctor doing your job in a little town in Canada, minding your own business and loving the work that you did with the community that you live with. Give us a little picture of how big your town is and whereabouts you live and how many patients you have.
Well, I live in a fairly scruffy little town called Lytton in British Columbia. And I moved here in 1993 to be the family doctor. And I was the only doctor in town for most of the time I've been here. I've been literally the only doctor. So I delivered babies. I did everything. I was, you know, truly a generalist in the old-fashioned sense of the word. And I remember this is a mostly Canadian First Nations town. About 70% of the people are Canadian Indians. And in the second year that I was here, which was in 1994, my father and mother came to visit me. And my father said to me, "What on earth are you doing here?" He said to me, "You are stuck in a back eddy. You will never make a name for yourself in a place like this." And I said to him, "I'm not trying to make a name for myself. I just want to serve these people." And that is, I suppose, my spirit. And I was raised with sort of Anglican Christian values of considering others more important than yourself. And beyond that, I embraced that because I became a Christian. I wasn't just raised Christian. I embraced Christ, who taught us what it means to consider others more important than yourself. And that is that's where our sense of social responsibility comes from. That's where our sense of duty to our fellow man comes from, where one should be willing, if need be, to sacrifice oneself for the well-being of those around us. And I think that's what's really inspired me. I haven't done any of this for me. I've done this for the love of my fellow man. That's what Christ did when he went to the cross. That's my life, and that's who I am.
And as we're going to come on to hear, you really have sacrificed yourself in every way. And we'll come on to that. But not only were you doing your social duty, your Christian duty, and your duty as a doctor, do no harm, you also decided to go one step further, didn't you, as well? Because you decided that you'd start your own little research project and you just keep an eye on what was going on with your patients. Tell us what you were noticing in your patients specifically and what measures you were taking to help them and to also record what you were seeing.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing because the practice of medicine is always a process of inquiry. We realize that we don't know it all and we don't have all the answers. And so we're supposed to always question everything to see if what we're doing is actually right, or what we're doing is actually the best, and how we could refine it or improve it. And so, fortunately, my open letter announcing all the neurological problems that my patients were having after their mRNA shot attracted, you know, international attention. And I was connected with a group of people from Doctors for COVID Ethics, who and then we had some wonderful weekly Zoom meetings trying to figure out what was causing the vaccine injuries that we were seeing, because this was a completely new technology with most unusual side effects. And so I started doing this blood test called a D-dimer test, and it was based on the idea that the delivery system of this messenger RNA is a delivery system that was previously used for cancer treatments. Our bodies have natural barriers, particularly the blood-brain barrier, but there's a placental barrier, and there are various other barriers that keep toxic substances out of sensitive parts of our body. And the delivery system that was chosen for the mRNA shots was designed to get through those barriers, to literally get that mRNA into literally every part of your body, into your brain, into your lungs, your heart, places where vaccines aren't supposed to go. And so I realized that those spike proteins were going to be made in the cells around your blood vessels in every part of your body, and that most of it would actually be in the cells around capillary networks, because that's where most of the absorption of anything from your bloodstream occurs. It occurs in capillary networks because that's where the blood streams, the blood slows right down. That's where you've got the biggest surface area relative to the blood volume. And so I realized that the lining of those capillaries was going to be rough, full of spike proteins rather than smooth. And so I thought then it is absolutely inevitable that clotting is going to occur, and it's going to be mostly microclotting in these capillary networks. And so in order to try and figure that out, I started doing this blood test called a D-dimer test. Now, before I should say that, I should also mention that I was considered literally a few weeks after sending my open letter, the authorities were furious with me and were determined to try and shut me down. So at one point, we had a vaccine injured nurse that came into our emergency room. Sorry, not a vaccine injured nurse, a vaccine injured patient. And this was a patient who had COVID 5 weeks before, and for whom it was a very mild event. You know, it really wasn't a serious thing, not as bad as the flu. But this person then had a COVID shot 5 weeks later and got very sick from their COVID shot. So for this person, clearly the injection was more dangerous than COVID. So I told the nurse to tell the patient that clearly, because she had such a mild infection, she had natural immunity and she didn't need to be vaccinated because she had natural immunity. And the nurse said to me, she's not allowed to tell anyone that they don't need this injection. Doesn't matter what kind of immunity they've got. So I said, well, that's okay. I'll explain it to the patient. So anyway, on the basis of me telling a nurse that a person with natural immunity to COVID didn't need the injection, I was fired from the emergency room. So fortunately, I still had my medical license, but I was fired for telling this emergency room nurse that a person who was vax injured and had clear natural immunity didn't need the shot. And I'd been doing emergency medicine in that emergency room for almost 30 years, but, you know, elsewhere for longer than that. With literally at that time, not a single patient complaint against me, I was fired for making that statement. So they were desperately trying to shut me down and shut me up and trying to intimidate me. But I was determined. I knew I had a sense of social responsibility to try and help my patients, because I was trying to figure out, how do I treat these vaccine injuries? We didn't even know what the mechanism of injury was, about why people were getting these side effects. And so I started doing this D-dimer test, and I was looking for patients who hadn't had their shot yet so that they could do this D-dimer test before and after their shot. So a D-dimer test is a blood test that is usually done to see if you have a blood clot somewhere in your body. And it won't detect an old blood clot. It only detects recent new blood clots. So I was looking for people who hadn't had their shot yet, who I could get a baseline D-dimer, do another one a week later, and see if they were getting this microclotting. And so I discovered, much to my horror, when I got literally the first 8 people's blood work back and 5 out of the 8 had a positive D-dimer, I was absolutely horrified. I realized that the blood clots were not rare, that we were told that they're 1 in 1 million or 1 in 100,000, incredibly rare. It was 62%. In my patients. And so I was so horrified. I had an interview coming up with one of the local people here in Canada, and they asked to tell me about what was happening in my patients. And I told them, I said, look, this is very early days. I've only got 8 people's results back, but more than half have clotting. And the problem with that is that obviously clotting firstly permanently damages vessels, and secondly, it's going to accumulate with every shot. And the most horrifying thing is that these were not vaccine-injured people. These were people who thought their shot went fine and were having these microscopic blood clots in their brain and wherever else. So tragically, a little over a week after that, our entire town burned to the ground. And this wasn't a fire. We had a horrible heat wave. And shortly after that, something lit a spark. And our entire town on a very windy day literally was annihilated. And 90% of the town was eradicated, including my medical practice, including the emergency room that I'd been fired from. It all went up in smoke. When I ran out of that building and when everything was burning, I just grabbed my laptop, grabbed my D-dimer research, I grabbed a few of the duplicated patient files on the vaccine injuries because people kept asking me about them, and I lost everything else. But fortunately, my house survived because my house was upwind of the fire and not in the village. So my house survived, but I'd lost my medical practice. I was fired from this. I couldn't then do emergency medicine anywhere. And so I then went to another town. I had moved my wife and my family to another town about 2 hours' drive away to try and give my children more of an opportunity to a university town, a bigger town, because they clearly needed more than this little one-horse town could offer them. So I moved them there in a few years before to try and just for the benefit of my children. But I didn't realize that my wife was strategically planning a divorce. And when I arrived there, literally 2 o'clock in the morning, having fled from this burning town, I shortly after that discovered I was given these divorce papers that told me I was going to be banished from this house with a no contact order. And that, so I couldn't go back to the burned out town of Lytton, and I couldn't be there. And so I had to decide, well, my life is crumbling around me. Where do I go next? So I was still trying, my patients obviously that were scattered far and wide still needed healthcare. So at that point, I was giving them my cell phone number so that they could reach me wherever I was, so that I could still care for them. And so I put the word out that I was going to go to my little cottage, which was about 6 hours' drive away, and I would be able to help them from there by telephone. And so, of course, the authorities, which were still seeking things to accuse me of, then submitted a complaint to the College of Physicians or Surgeons that I had abandoned my patients and gone to this cottage. So, I mean, they were literally, as everything crumbled around me, they redoubled their efforts to try and find points of accusation. And so, yeah, it's been a tough time.
As we said right from the beginning, you have literally sacrificed everything. But just to summarize, because some people that are listening might find all of this a little bit overwhelming. Because you've been demonized and hounded and bullied, in my opinion, by your colleagues. You've been betrayed by them. All you've ever wanted to do is the right thing, do no harm. Your town burnt down. And I mean, you know, when I first heard this, I thought, what? You know, a house burning down. We hear about that, sadly. A town, a whole town burning down, your medical center burnt to the ground. And then your wife divorcing you. All of this to one person, on top of what we're going to come to, which is the courts, trials, disciplinaries, and everything else that you're having to go through at the moment. But I just want to come back to the fire quickly, because you've told me that for 2 years, this happened a couple of years ago, and for 2 years, your town was roped off while they were doing investigations, while they were trying to find out what the cause was of the fire. And I mean, plenty of people that lost their homes, I'm sure, maybe didn't have insurance. So tell us where the town is now. I mean, the cordons have all gone, I presume, or is it still under investigation? A whole town has been wiped out. What is the reason?
Well, so the first thing they did was immediately after this, the fire had sort of died down, they fenced off the entire property, the entire area where the town was, not the surrounding area, but the town. And they literally had it guarded 24 hours a day for 2 years. Now, their reasoning was that they said it wasn't safe, you know, and of course, that's the eternal reason for everything that the authorities do is safety. You know, that's what all the masks were about, the lockdowns, the shots, the travel restrictions. It was all about safety. You know, that's their excuse for everything. And so it wasn't safe, but also that it was under investigation. And so anyway, the government investigated it for a year. And after a year, they announced that they had absolutely no idea what caused the fire. There's two railways that go through town, and somebody said, well, it was caused by a train that was on fire. But, you know, if it had been a train on fire, and the trains go through here about 70 kilometers an hour, the fire would have been all the way down the track. You know, there would have been other places where it had ignited it further down, and there was nowhere else. It was absolutely nowhere else. So that theory of the train on fire doesn't fly. It was impossible. But and they wouldn't let, you know, I wanted to go back to my medical practice and at least see if I could salvage my surgical instruments and things that I knew wouldn't have been destroyed, but they would not let. I couldn't get anything, nothing. I mean, it was a complete loss. And because it's a humble small town, literally 60% of people had no insurance. And so because of all these safety regulations, it has taken an absurd amount of time. They're finally now, it's almost 3 years since the fire, and there are about three houses now under construction, but most of it has been delayed by safety regulations. And then the second thing that's delayed it is that the First Nations people, who are the Canadian Indians, get all sorts of enormous grants from the government for cultural preservation. And so they have had an archaeological company that has to sift through every grain of sand where all these houses used to be in case there's an arrowhead or a bone or something from times gone by. And of course, a lot of people here collected arrowheads and they walked all around the surrounding areas and they pick up these stone arrowheads because the First Nations people were Stone Age people here before Europeans came. And so you can find these arrowheads. And of course, when the house burns, what's left behind in the ash are these arrowheads. But now this now becomes an archaeological site because there are arrowheads there. And so this has also created enormous expense and enormous delays. All of this, it's about cultural preservation, but it's reached absurd proportions.
Where are you now? Was there anything left of the town? You say that your house was saved, but how many other people in the town are left? And if you've moved back into the town, I'm presuming that you're still opening your doors to patients. Am I right?
Yes. So now there is no. Well, as I say, I lost all my medical equipment, which included bedside ultrasound and other things that I had bought, that I had in my private practice, which was in the same building, actually, as that emergency room that I was banned from. I lost all of that. So I had to sort of retool to some degree. I couldn't afford another ultrasound machine and that sort of thing. But I bought instruments and other things because people were literally, once I moved back, they were literally coming and knocking on my door. You know, people would come and say, you know, I just took the end of my finger off with my circular saw. Please, can you help me? Or I've got, you know, I was pruning my apple tree and I've got something in my eye. Or I've got this really sore throat, or I think I'm getting pneumonia or whatever it is. And they would literally come and knock on my door because there's no other emergency services here. And so I literally now treat people in my own home and who literally just come to the door and say, I need help. And so obviously I've had to, and previously the government paid for all of this, you know, if they needed dressings or, you know, suturing or whatever else, the government provided all of that and paid me for doing it, for actually being available for the emergency room. So I can still, fortunately, I still do have a medical license, so I can get recoup some money for fixing up a chopped off finger or something. But obviously my overheads are much higher because I'm now providing all of the dressing supplies and other things like that that would normally have been provided by the government.
You've also got loads of legal fees as well, I have to say, haven't you, as well, which we will come on to. So anybody that's listening thinking, I want to help Dr. Hoff, even if it's buying an instrument or contributing towards your pages, then we are going to come on to that. I absolutely promise, because your sense of social honesty is simply phenomenal. But I just want to bring you back very quickly to the vaccine adverse reactions, because since then, you know, you're still trying to help people still today. And what happens when you make the call to, say, a neurologist, for example, because you've got a patient that's presenting with neurological problems, and I know that you've tried very hard to get them referred. What happens when you do that?
It's astonishing, the level of denial in the medical community. So initially, when I tried to find a neurologist who would see my vaccine-injured patients, and I desperately just wanted a diagnosis, because you can't treat something if you don't know what the diagnosis is. You know, it's like a mechanic on a car. You can't fix the car unless you know what's gone wrong. So as doctors, we've got to be able to diagnose things. And I had no idea what was causing all the neurological problems that my patients had. And so I phoned three tertiary, big, you know, large medical centers, what we call tertiary hospitals here, with neurological, neurology departments, and to try and find a neurologist who would see my most seriously vaccine-injured patients at short notice. And in every single case, as soon as I mentioned that these symptoms started after their COVID vaccine, they would simply go quiet on the phone and then say, well, actually, that's not their field. And so after, literally, and these were the three largest hospitals surrounding, you know, in the surrounding area, two of them in Vancouver, another one in a town called Kamloops. And so I then didn't know what else to do. So I then literally just sent a letter to a neurologist. I sent them six letters on my most seriously injured, six most seriously neurologically injured patients, and marked them as urgent referrals. So these people were given an appointment date that was 5 months after their vaccine injury. They literally didn't want to see these people. With one of them, the youngest, who was a 38-year-old lady who had five cranial nerve palsies, whose life was ruined by her after her first shot. She couldn't drive, she couldn't work, and this so-called urgent referral was going to be 5 months after her shot. When this neurologist eventually saw her, he was so horrified that he admitted her to hospital for 8 days to try and figure out what was happening to her. So these people thought, I think they just thought I was exaggerating. But the fact that they wouldn't even look, they wouldn't even see these, I mean, this was appalling. I just think this is a dereliction of duty. And in so many cases, these poor vaccine-injured people were just told it was all in their head. Because, you know, these spike proteins are not human proteins. They're not supposed to be in our body. They're a very toxic foreign protein that the medical system had no tests for. There's no test to see how many spike proteins you've got. And so these doctors didn't know how to diagnose these. The problems didn't show up unless you had a huge blood clot. A lot of it does not show up. Like on that patient with the five cranial nerve palsies, they keep doing MRIs. Nothing shows up. They don't know why she doesn't get better. It, it, I think now I realize it's an autoimmune problem, but it's called a small fiber neuropathy. But this was like a stealth weapon that caused problems that the medical system literally couldn't detect, but more concerned, they didn't want to know about them. This was a cruel thing to these vaccine injured people, because most, you know, I've now got 32 vaccine injured people in my little medical practice, and I'm a one man practice. It's a small practice with 32 vaccine injured people. And as I say, after the first 14 vaccine injury reports, I gave up because I realized you can't report them. The whole system is censored so that they can carry on telling people how amazingly rare the side effects are. And the rest of the doctors don't seem to want to report them either. I think they're terrified of being called an anti-vaxxer. So the medical profession has literally betrayed people, the people who they're supposed to be serving. And it grieves me terribly that they're, and I think some of it has just been quite simply, they were brainwashed from watching their television set. They were brainwashed into believing that the vaccine injuries are incredibly rare. And so if something bad is happening, well, it can't be the vaccine because that's safe and effective. And the side effects are incredibly rare. So it's got to be something else, even if we can't think of what that something else might be. Yeah, that's been my experience of very deep disappointment in the medical profession, who I really think have acted in a very selfish, self-serving way. You know, the old-fashioned ethic of going into medicine for doctors and nurses and physiotherapists and other people was that you wanted to serve people. You didn't go into this for personal gain. It was a calling. It's a bit like going into the ministry, you know, to be clergy. It's a calling where you don't do it for yourself. You do it to serve others. And unfortunately, that old-fashioned Christian ethic of considering others more important than yourself seems to have gone. And it's tragically sad.
Oh, my goodness, you are a doctor after my own heart, and I would love to be a matron in your hospital, that's for sure, because I agree with you. As a nurse, as a gobby granny, as I call myself, and you as a rural, quiet, humble GP, you knew, I knew, we knew what was going on, so there is no excuse. Of course, they must know what's going on. And if they didn't know, if others doctors didn't know what was going on, then I suggest they should ask some questions or perhaps come and speak to us, because, you know, it does sound cheesy to say that medicine's a calling and that becoming a doctor is a calling and a nurse. It does sound a bit cheesy, but it's true. I wanted to be a nurse from when I was 11 years old. And that's exactly what I did. I was focused and there was nobody and nothing that was going to stop me, because I wanted to be a nurse, because I wanted to help people. It was really that simple. I didn't do it for the money. Nobody does it for the money, and nobody does it for easy hours either, or an easy time or an easy job. I wanted to do it because I cared. And you are a doctor that listens to patients, which is so important. And through the whole of this pandemic, I have found the most important things, or one of the most important things, is doctors holding space for patients, listening to them, and more importantly, believing them. We've had many people that we've interviewed who have had serious neurological illness, serious adverse reactions from the injection, serious cardiac and immune damage. And yet they've been told, you're anxious. It's all down to anxiety. It's all down to some psychosomatic thought. It's not real. It doesn't exist. And so that's why patients, when they meet doctors like you, are so relieved. At last, somebody's listening to me. At last, somebody's believing me. And at last, somebody can help me and advise me. And, you know, you've been through all of this, Charles. You've been through a divorce. You've been through discreditation. You've been through being bullied by your colleagues. You've been through fire. But there's worse as well. As if we didn't think there was more to come, tell us about the legal action and the actions of your own professional body and how they've reacted to you and the impact that that's taken on you.
Let me back up a little bit. So I told you about how I was fired from the ER and all of the trials and tribulations that I'd been to. So when I was finally allowed back to my house in this evacuation area, because fortunately, as I said, my house wasn't in the fenced off part. Well, it was for a while, but even though it wasn't burnt, when I was eventually allowed back there, was around about the time that they were saying that they wanted to start giving these COVID shots to children. And, you know, as I've mentioned, the risk of COVID was for everyone was massively exaggerated. It was only really dangerous to the frail elderly. And we knew that it was almost no risk to children. And so when they were saying that and Pfizer or Moderna or AstraZeneca, any of these other, they hadn't tested it on children. But yet when they said they were going to roll this out for children and they were making it a requirement for university entrance or for playing sport or for all sorts of things, I was horrified because I knew that a lot of these spike proteins ended up in the ovaries and the testicles, the reproductive organs. And I thought this seems like a genocide. If these people are getting microclotting in their reproductive organs, This is going to seriously reduce fertility. It has to. When a baby girl is born, she's born with all the eggs she'll ever have in her whole life. She doesn't make new eggs the way males make sperms every day. Girls don't do that. If you can reduce the number of the eggs in of the ovaries of a child, she will have permanently impaired fertility. And so I teamed up with another doctor here in British Columbia who had also been outspoken about this. And we went on a speaking tour through Western Canada. And I think ultimately went to 40 or 50 cities, literally doing town hall presentations. And it was motivated on trying to protect the children. A lot of the adults had already been vaccinated. But I was just... the fact that they would wanted to give this to children and in many cases were forcing them to have it in order to be able to enroll in education or play sport was very sinister because COVID was almost no risk to them. And of course, they were telling them that, you know, unless you have these shots, you're going to kill your grandmother or whatever, which was absurd because their shots couldn't stop transmission. And so all of that was a lie too. So I went on this speaking tour. And maybe I should even back up a bit further. After sending my open letter talking about the neurological problems that my patients were having and giving them the numbers, numbers vaccinated, numbers injured, numbers treated for COVID, all of that, and literally showing that this whole thing was, the shots were more dangerous than COVID, the colleges of physicians and surgeons, who are the licensing authorities in each province across Canada, issued a warning after I sent that letter because they considered my open letter to be misinformation. Talking about vaccine injuries was misinformation. These shots are safe and effective. You're not allowed to talk about vaccine injuries because it's misinformation. So they put out a warning to every doctor warning that if you spread misinformation about COVID, you will be investigated and, if necessary, disciplined. So my letter seemed to trigger that. So I was already under investigation. I was already, under fire. And my medical ethic was still there to do no harm and to protect my patients and the public at large who were being deceived. They had been brainwashed with fear through their television set and were now being convinced to have these shots that they didn't need. And that was seriously doing harm. And so the fact that I was on a speaking tour going town to town trying to warn people to protect their children riled the authorities even more. So They then issued the citation against me. So a citation is basically it's a statement of accusation. So I was sitting in at my desk doing telephone appointments, caring for my patients, and the phone went, and it was a reporter in Toronto asking for my comments about the citation. I said, "Well, what citation?" And so they said, "Well, it's all over the news." So I said, "Oh, okay. Well, tell me about it. What are they doing now?" So so this reporter told me that the College of Physicians and Surgeons had put out this press announcement that I was going to be disciplined. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I thought at least they might have had the decency to tell me first. So I literally had to go onto their website and look up to see what they were going to do to me next. And I thought, you know, this is clearly an act of intimidating every doctor. The fact that I am now going to be disciplined for my spreading misinformation, for what they call professional misconduct, is what they're calling it. The fact that they put this out across in all the main media across Canada about this spreader of misinformation and what they were going to be doing to me, I thought, wow, you know, this is clearly, that's why most of the doctors just keep their head down and won't say a word. They have been intimidated. And so, you know, fortunately, I'm not a naturally fearful person. I don't consider myself the most important thing out there. I love my neighbor more than I love myself. And so I carried on doing what I was doing. But anyway, so this, my trial was supposed to have happened a short time ago. So firstly, I've got a brilliant Christian lawyer called Lee Turner, who is an incredibly clever and conscientious man, and who shares the same ethic as I do. And he has recruited 8 world experts as expert witnesses who have given expert testimonies to defend everything that I'm accused of. And of course, the microclotting is misinformation, and neurological injuries are misinformation, and the fact that this could harm fertility is misinformation, and a lot of people have died from these shots, that's misinformation. So they've got this list of all these things. So shortly before the trial, after my lawyer had submitted all the expert testimonies from these 8 world experts, the college clearly realized that they were seriously outgunned and outmaneuvered, and that they didn't have a leg to stand on. So their response was to ask for something called judicial notice. So judicial notice is a principle of Canadian law where a court can declare that certain facts are indisputable and therefore cannot be contested. And so they're basically saying that the facts stated by the college and public health, the first fact is the vaccines work. The second one is they're safe and effective, you know, and on and on. So they're claiming that this is irrefutable evidence. And therefore, if the court will accept that this is irrefutably correct, I mean, everyone knows that, then you're not allowed to contest it. Which therefore prevents me from giving any evidence in my defense, because I'm not allowed to contest that information that these shots are safe and effective. I've said they've caused serious vaccine injuries in my own patients and around the world, and I'm a firsthand witness of that as a family doctor. So they are trying to basically bury the evidence through this process called judicial notice. And so they haven't decided yet if they're going to grant judicial notice. But I mean, if they do, the fact that they're even trying to do this shows that the College of Physicians and Surgeons is not interested in truth. They're not interested in justice. They literally just want to bury the evidence. So this is what's happened. Everything that's happened to me, right from the first gag order, right to this judicial notice, just shows the level of corruption that is just endemic. It seems to reveal everything that is wrong with the legal system and the medical system. So, I mean, it's sort of interesting to see what God will do next, because this has been quite an adventure.
I'm not sure I'd call it an adventure quite, but I mean, Charles, I think it's important to let people know too that your world experts, your eight world experts, were working, had done the reports pro bono, were absolutely behind your cause, 100%. Just give us an idea of some of those world experts that are willing and ready to stand up for you, because you've been working with COVID, the COVID doctors for a long time. You've also stood up publicly at the Canada Citizens Inquiry. So who is going to be standing up for you if they allow people to give evidence on your behalf?
Absolutely. So these expert witnesses, I can give you their names. So from the UK, it's Dr. Claire Craig, who's a pathologist. And of course, pathological evidence is very important. And so anyway, he's one of them. Dr. Peter McCulloch, who's a world-renowned cardiologist and epidemiologist from Texas. Dr. Pierre Corey, who's the world expert on ivermectin, because, of course, this is one of the accusations against me, is that I told people to use ivermectin, even, you know, when doctors were banned in Canada from prescribing ivermectin for COVID. You could prescribe it for anything else, but not COVID. It was not safe to use for COVID, but it was safe for anything else. I mean, go and figure out the logic in that. Dr. Stephen Pellick, who is he's a professor at the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Jessica Rose, who is a world-renowned virologist and immunologist. Dr. James Thorpe, who is a gynecologist from the United States, who has been very outspoken about what this has done to fertility in women. And Dr. Eric Payne, who is a pediatric neurologist in Edmonton, Canada. And the last is Dr. Kevin McKernan. Now, he's not a medical doctor. He's the scientist who revealed the DNA plasmid, the contamination with E. coli, with plasmid DNA in these shots that will literally genetically, that gives it the ability to genetically modify us, because it's DNA, not RNA. So these are these world experts, and each of these people has literally offered to give their testimony free of charge. Now, my lawyer said that because of the caliber of these people, if they had charged what people of this caliber are entitled to charge for their expert testimony, I would probably be on the hook for about $400,000 in legal fees just for these expert testimonies. These people have worked for days and weeks preparing their expert testimonies because they support me 100%. And so they have said, just on a matter of principle, they will do this free of charge. Unfortunately, with all that they've been, the college has been throwing at my lawyer, he's had to recruit other lawyers. And so, of course, the legal costs are mounting. And so I'm sort of at the mercy of the goodwill of the public to try and help me with this, because I think my case, because it deals with critical areas of patient safety and vaccine injury, it'll be a precedent-setting case. I don't know if it'll help things the rest of the world, but definitely in Canada, it will help many other medical professionals who are facing the same charges and the same problems. This will be a precedent-setting case, and so I think it's very important that it is won, and the fact that I've got these eight world experts who are being muzzled by the authorities. You know, these people have submitted, I think it's a total of 967 pages of expert testimony in total between the eight of them. So this is a vast amount of very important medical information that my lawyer would like to make available to the world, that anyone can draw on this for other cases. You know, even if they're not allowed to be submitted as court documents, we will make this information available because the world needs to know. There needs to be some accountability for the people who have betrayed humanity in what they have done in this pandemic.
I'm going to ask you in a minute for where people can help with donations, where your pages are. We're going to get those up as well in the article that's going to be appearing beneath this interview. But am I right in believing, Charles, that in Canada, and please to everybody watching in Canada, to everybody watching everywhere, please share this interview. Please support Dr. Hoff. It is incredibly, it's vital. It's vital that we support our own. And so Canada, UK, the world, I hope you're listening. But I do think I want to ask you this one question because I think it's very important. Am I right in the fact that in Canada, although, Charles, you've got a wonderful lawyer, and as you said, your lawyer's having to get advice from other people, and that's racking up fees. But do you have to pay the fees of your professional body who are taking this action against you as well? Because that's not what happens, I believe, in the UK. But is this what is happening in Canada at the moment?
Yes. Yeah. So the pattern seems to be, and I have got this from two other doctors that have had the same issues, is that they issue this citation against you. They put you under investigation. They spend a lot of money investigating you, and then they give you the bill. So this happened to Dr. Mark Trozzi in Ontario. He was an emergency room doctor who, in a COVID-designated hospital, who realized that this was a scamdemic, that there actually wasn't any increase in the number of people dying until the vaccine rollout happened, and literally gave up the practice of medicine in order to try and reveal this corruption full time. So he recently had a trial, it was towards the end of last year, where he lost his case. His medical license is revoked, and he was given the bill for $95,000, which was the legal bill from the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons for investigating him. And so this is what they do. You know, so people say, well, what's worst case scenario? Well, worst case scenario is that they will revoke my medical license so that I can't earn any money to pay my bills. And that they will give me, it's going to be probably into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. They have spent a lot of money investigating me, trying to find fault. I could end up with a crushing bill from the medical establishment for my so-called spreading misinformation. So that seems to be what they do. And of course, this is all designed to intimidate other doctors. We now have a law in British Columbia called Bill 36, where if a doctor speaks misinformation, you can get a $200,000 fine and 6 months in jail. So it's hard to believe that this is reality, but this is where we've got to in British Columbia. So, of course, misinformation is anything that the government doesn't agree with is misinformation. So it's very arbitrary and doesn't have to be based on truth. But that doesn't just wipe out freedom of speech. That wipes out informed consent, you know, because as you know, Debbie, as a nurse, before any medical procedure, you're supposed to tell them the pros and cons and give the person the choice of whether or not they want that medical procedure. And you have to be able to tell them your concerns with why it may not be safe or why it may be safe. And if you're not allowed to speak freely in case the government doesn't agree, you can't give informed consent anymore. So that is how far down this hellhole Canada has sunk, sadly. Technically I'm in line for all of that. And this is what they're using to intimidate doctors into just towing the party line.
Charles, informed consent doesn't exist. Let's be real about this. It doesn't exist. They can't inform you of anything because they're not being told. I received a letter from the president of the Royal College of General Practitioners in the UK, and I'd asked him why doctors weren't informing patients of the injection and the ingredients of the injection. And he wrote me back a letter to say that doctors couldn't inform patients because they weren't told the ingredients of the injection. And he put that in writing, and we've showed it on the column many times. But, you know, sometimes as a nurse, I have to look after the doctors, and many nurses that are watching that trained in the same time as I did will know that nurses end up looking after the doctors. We were the ones that made you slices of toast at 3 o'clock in the morning on the ward. And I'm just going to look after you now a little bit, because I asked you a big question a minute ago, but of course you're thinking about other people, you're thinking about your patients, you're thinking about the public before you're thinking about yourself. So I'm going to ask you again, tell us where to send donations. Where are your pages? What are the links that people can go to help you helping us?
Yeah, thank you. So I do not have a website or a Facebook page or anything. One of the accusations of the college against me is that I have spread misinformation on social media. So, I mean, it's interesting that I have never in my life ever put anything on social media. I'm not on LinkedIn. I'm not on anything. And I've kept it that way just to show how absurd the accusations of the college are, because, you know, there's not a lot of people that have never put anything on social media. But I'm one of them. So, I do have a donations website at GiveSendGo. And so, I mean, I was banned from PayPal for, according to them, for violating community standards. At one point, somebody tried to set up a PayPal fund to raise some money for me after the fire to try and buy some medical equipment. It was shut down by PayPal in 24 hours because they said I had violated community standards. And so, anyway, this is just what happens, I suppose. It comes from every side. So there is a link at GiveSendGo, and so this is purely, none of this money comes to me. It all goes to the lawyers to pay for all of their legal expenses, which seem to be mounting because they are absolutely determined to not let me be vindicated. And so, unfortunately, the costs are rising. They're literally giving this all they've got. And of course, the judicial notice is the ultimate to, you know, prevent the truth from coming out.
I would urge everybody, if you possibly can, especially those of you in Canada, please, please support Dr. Hoff. And there's a million questions. If you could see me now, I've got a million pieces of notepaper around me with so many questions. But I have a really important question for you, and this comes from us here in the UK, from UK Column. And what we want to ask you is, how are you? How are you, Dr. Hoff? Are you getting any support, and what support are you getting?
Yes, I'm getting wonderful support. From, interestingly enough, more and more from my patients, but often people would say, so what do your patients think about this? So as I mentioned, my patients are mostly very humble, largely uneducated people who just watch their television set, and that's where they get their information from. And so even though I've been their family doctor for 30 years, and they have trusted me implicitly, they know that I am a spreader of misinformation and I'm in trouble with the authorities, and they don't quite know how to put this together. Obviously, I must have done something wrong, otherwise I wouldn't be in trouble. But so it's created a bit of a dilemma for many of them, because they don't listen to the UK column or read things from the alternative media. They're just told that I'm in trouble. But I do get wonderful support from people who love truth and freedom all across, well, partly some from across the world, but mostly in British Columbia, who have been very generous. You know, sometimes, you know, they know I live in a burnt out town where you can't buy anything. I mean, you can buy petrol, but that's and you can buy junk food at the petrol station, but that's about it. There's no supermarket. So I sometimes have people that literally come and just fill my fridge with food because they know that I've got a long drive to get to a grocery store. But no, I am well. I my faith is in God. I haven't done what I've done for myself. I've done it for my fellow man. And I have no regrets. I sleep well at night because this is God's battle. There's a war against humanity. And people need to realize that. You know, in Canada, we have these terrible euthanasia laws. They've now killed, up until the end of last year, 60,000 Canadians who are either elderly or disabled have been killed by their doctors through euthanasia. Doctors aren't supposed to do this. You know, Canada still kills 100,000 babies a year through abortion. There's a war against humanity. And of course, this pandemic was just a whole new dimension on that, a war against humanity. And tragically, the medical profession is right at the heart of it. It is tragic. I mean, the profession that is supposed to be about keeping people well and preserving life and health seems to have been turned on its head. I just keep hoping that more doctors will stand up against what is happening. It just troubles me. You know, the medical profession used to be one of the most trusted professions. And now I endlessly have people coming to me saying, please, will you be my doctor? Because I don't trust my doctor anymore. He told me those shots were safe and effective when there was no evidence that they were. And now I've got all these problems or whatever it is. There's a crisis. This has been a moral integrity test for everyone, for the legal profession, for our elected officials, for the government, for the medical profession. It's been a moral integrity test, and most people have failed dismally because they literally just looked after themselves. They did not consider others more important than themselves. They just did what was good for them. And that's not the way things should be. We need to be considering others more important than ourselves. And that's where our sense of social responsibility comes from. But it's an old-fashioned Christian ethic. You know, we live in a postmodernist world where you know, truth is relative and you do what works for you. And it's all based on pragmatism, which never works because there are ethics that are far greater than us that we need to be upholding.
Charles, your passion, your tender loving care, TLC, determination, honesty, Christianity, it shines. I just see this beautiful warm light. So Charles, before I throw to you for the last word, what I really would like to do is just to ask you if there's anything that we've missed out, because of course your court appearance was going to be the 4th of March and I believe that that's been adjourned. So perhaps you could just give us a little summary on that.
Yes. So the next deadline in terms of court proceedings will be April the 19th, which was when, so this sort of jury, which is called the disciplinary panel, which has been appointed by the college to discipline me, they will sit on the 19th of April to decide whether they're going to grant judicial notice or not. And so, in other words, they will decide whether or not I'm allowed to defend myself. And if I'm not, if I can't defend myself, well, then I suppose there's no trial. I'm just guilty. And I'll get all the fines. So that's the next deadline, is 19th of April.
I'm speechless because you've been through everything. You've literally lost everything. I can't begin to know how you must possibly feel. And that's why I'm so keen for people, please share this video. Please pass the information around. We all need doctors like Dr. Charles Hoff. We all need our hands held. We all need a door to knock on when we haven't got anywhere else to go. And I want to thank you so much, not just for appearing on UK Column and not just telling us your story, but for all you are doing for humanity, because you really are fighting the fight. You really have sacrificed everything. Thank you so much. And on that note, Dr. Charles Hoff, in Canada, your last words.
I think my last words are very simple. And this, and it's simply to consider others more important than yourself. This is the very basic Christian ethic from the Bible of the ultimate humility in serving others and in doing your duty is to consider others more important than yourself. I think there is no higher ethic than that.